Hey, this is a dark tangent. Organizer of DEF CON. You're about to listen to some speeches from DEF CON 3, held July 4th, 5th, and 6th at the Tropicana Hotel in Las Vegas, Nevada, 1995. Now, the Tropicana has since been renovated. This speech and all speeches are copywritten, all rights reserved, the Dark Tangent, and DEF CON Communications. Permission is expressly granted, though, for educational, non-profit use. If you have any more questions about DEF CON, or want to send me some email about the copyright status, please email me at dt@defcon.org, or the website is www.defcon.org. Now, kick back, get ready for some good speeches, and thanks for supporting us. Wait, whoa.
Oh, my.
I'm forgetting something. Two things. Windows NT 3.1 in Spanish. I don't know anything about these. They appeared mysteriously, but they say digital decay BBS. 750 megs, pure HP, DNA Magazine, world headquarters. So if you can decode it. I'll kill you with this thing if I huck it in your direction. Was that someone's head cracking open? Okay, now we're ready for Susan Thunder. Much awaited. She shifted down to this category. You've read her biography. She's going to do a CEPIS talk. And what more is there to say? Susan Thunder.
About doing the cute jump, but I'd probably fall on my ass. So. Well, this is really cool, man. I can't believe this turnout tonight. This is great. I want to thank Dark Tangent for inviting me to speak here and the staff of DEF CON 3. It's a real pleasure to get back out again. I haven't done one of these shows in like a real long time. I'm going to talk about social engineering, which I like to call psychological subversion. And the reason I call it psychological subversion is because I have never liked the term social engineering. To me, that's something that Hitler did to the Jews during World War III. It's not a term that describes what we do. World War II, maybe? No, I'm not nervous. I also have some notes here. Okay. Basically, I titled this STEPS Theory, and the reason I'm calling it STEPS now is that combines both acronyms, social engineering and psychological subversion. Traditionally, the difference between the two has been that psychological subversion was a technique that was used more in corporate espionage. It's planning an attack, whereas like social engineering is usually very quick. You just get on the line and you call the CO and you know, have something typed into the mini or whatever. But psychological subversion is where you plan an attack. And recently this technique is finally drawing some attention because I've been teaching the technique as a way to get around encryption. As more and more people start using PGP and other methods of encrypting data, you know, the clueless fools out there using the Clipper chip, you want to find a way to get to that data when it's not feasible to de-encrypt the data. So what better way than to have somebody read it off the screen to you? Or better yet, to have them just print it out and send it to you. So that's what I'm going to teach tonight, is a method to just have them print it out and send it to you. Basically, what's happened out there is people are becoming more security conscious. And the more hardware and software that they install to secure a system, the more vulnerable the system is to these techniques. So actually, it's in my best interest, as somebody that practices psychological subversion or social engineering, the terms are starting to mean the same thing nowadays, it's in my best interest for them to install all kinds of, you know, fancy encryption methods and packet filters and firewalls and put the computer inside a facility that's got 10-foot thick lead walls and all that, because what's happening is the user does not take responsibility for the security. Years ago, you could get on a system and all the users had some awareness of the fact that they were responsible for their data, whether it was somebody in the accounting department or somebody in the data processing department that was an operator on the computer. The operators would run system status reports, and if they saw somebody they didn't know, they would check up on it. Well, nowadays, the operator runs a status report and says, well, God, with, you know, $2 million worth of firewalls and encryption and everything, if they're here, they've got to be okay, right? So it serves our best interest to let them go ahead and, you know, fire away with the hardware and software, because the individual users don't take responsibility. One thing I do want to tell is I've been asked by a lot of people, what, theoretically, is there any computer system that cannot be broken into? And I really believe that the only system that cannot be broken into is the hypothetical system that's in a bank vault with the 10-foot thick lead wall, so nobody can read the emanations off the wires. It has an independent power source inside the vault. The entire system is inside the vault. There's not even an electrical wire running out the door of the vault. And you give one person access to that vault, and I'll give you a pretty fair chance that that system is secure. But if you give even one additional person access, it's my contention that you have now compromised security by 50%. And the reason is because I am going to find a way to play the one person against the other if I want to get in, whether I use typical social engineering techniques and call as one person secretary to the other one's secretary while the one is out of town and perform some sort of ruse to gain access, or whether I just go seduce the guy and blackmail him afterwards. But whatever I do, if I want to get into that computer, I'm going to get into it. So that's one thing that I guess women hackers have over you guys. if you're willing to use it, which, again, that's a whole other story. Okay, the hypothetical system that I'm going to lay out here, suppose you want to gain access to the computer files of a given company. How would you go about planning an attack on that company's data when you know nothing about the company except its name and its location? I will explain the method whereby you can gain access to whatever data you want from the XYZ insurance company. The scenario will be this. A private investigator wants to hire you to get certain records from the database of the insurance company's computers. He works in the field of locating missing heirs, a subdiscipline of private investigatory work, whereby a detective locates money that is owed to a given party, and then contacts that party and informs them that he knows where there's $100,000 that's owed to them. But in order for him to tell you where the money is and how to get it, they must agree to sign over 33 1/3% of the money to him for his troubles. By the way, this is perfectly legal. His sources of unclaimed monies usually include banks, the IRS, Social Security, etc. But he gets the idea in his head that if he could find insurance, especially life insurance monies, that are owed to a particular beneficiary, he could really rake in a fortune. So he decides to hire a hacker to help him retrieve some useful and profitable information from the XYZ insurance company. He instructs the hacker to retrieve data from XYZ's databases that meet only the following criteria. 1. Life insurance policies must exceed $250,000. 2. The insured party must be 80 years of age or older. 3. The policy must have lapsed for at least 6 months. In other words, no payments have been made, so therefore the insured party is probably deceased. And 4, the name and address of the beneficiary must be retrieved as well. It doesn't take a rocket scientist or even a sanitation engineer to figure out that it is not in the best financial interest of the insurance company to locate these beneficiaries and pay out the hundreds of thousands, even millions of dollars in death benefits to the rightful heirs. So although many would argue that the hacker thus hired is acting in contravention to the established hacker ethic, the hacker accepts the job because, based on the principle that XYZ Insurance Company is just one more multi-billion dollar behemoth that is robbing the average person of what he rightfully paid for. And anyway, the hacker could use the money for a new 486-100 laptop. I will explain from beginning to end how to fulfill this hypothetical assignment. And it is hypothetical, okay? Hypothetical assignment using no more than social engineering and psychological subversion techniques. At no time will physical access or even dial-up access to XYZ's computers be required. At no time will a password even be needed. Yet the hacker will produce for his client within a week's time a printout from XYZ's database containing all of the information requested above. Okay, anybody have any ideas about how to start? Let's go. That's great. He's saying what you want to do is do some research on the company, get some background information about them, cross-reference them with other insurance companies, and find, first of all, a good target if your employer hasn't suggested a target to you. That's great. What's your name?
Dustin.
Dustin. Okay. We need more people with skills like yours. Okay, that's basically a good place to start, actually. What you want to do is you want to do some physical reconnaissance of the insurance company. Now, at this point, usually the client has suggested a target company. He knows that he wants to get into, well, in this case, XYZ Insurance Company. So what you would do is you would go and maybe do a trash run at the company. One of my favorite ruses to get into trash bins and detrashing, especially when there's a security guard at the site, is to get a bag of aluminum cans and fill it about a third full, and then you kind of go in, you dress kind of in like blue jeans and maybe a t-shirt that's like torn a little bit or something, like not like you're homeless, but definitely like you would be the kind of person that could benefit from the nickel to be retrieved from an aluminum can. And you go in and, you know, you go up to the guard and you say, hey, do you mind if I look for cans? And you're very non-threatening. You know, you're self-deprecating, you're humble, you don't threaten in any way. The guy wants to get back to reading his book and his bottle of whiskey is under the table anyway. So, I mean, he'd be happy to just get you out of the way. So you go in. The best thing to do is to actually get inside the dumpster. Again, we're dealing with paper here. We're usually not dealing with garbage like you'd find at a supermarket or something. So get inside the dumpster, and a flashlight is usually helpful. If you stay below the level of the top of the dumpster, the guard isn't going to see the flashlight. And you look for which, you know, the material, the computer printouts. In this particular case here, what we're looking for in this trash is intercompany memorandum forms. You want company letterhead, and of course it's okay if it's used because you want the material across the top, the format. You want computer printouts that'll give you a good idea of the types of systems they're using, the command syntax, and the format used in issuing commands. You're going to need to retrieve as much background on the company as you can get. So when you're done with the trashing episode, you know, of course, you put your documents inside the bag that's got the aluminum cans in it. And I like to use the real thick, hefty bags because these thin ones, I did have documents, like, go skewing out when I was walking past the guy, and he said, "What's all this paper?" And I said, "Well, you know, paper can be turned in, too, and be recycled." It's kind of funny. He bought it, too. I mean, I just picked it all up. And these rent-a-cops that used to guard Pacific Telephone COs, man, they were, like, really lame. We used to, like, all the time, we'd go into the same COs over and over, and they'd just be like, "Oh, hi, how you doing tonight?" You know. No company ID badge, nothing. Okay, so what you've got here now, you've retrieved some preliminary data about the company, and you've got the forms that they use for intercompany memorandums. You need to get a list of names, okay? What you want to do in this particular case is find out who the top boss, the big boss, is in charge of either the data processing department, or if they have their own auditing in-house. A lot of companies don't. They hire outside auditors. Some have both. But you want to kind of acquire, if you can find an intercompany directory or a list of names of employees, that's really helpful. A lot of times if you just request the shareholders report, that has a lot of data about a company that can be used against the company to compromise them. So you get these names. You particularly want secretaries' names, people that are basically paid to be helpful. This is what we run into with the phone company, is that these people, their whole job is customer service. It never even occurs to them to ask if you have access or should have access to the data you're requesting, because it's their job to help people get this data. So you want to find similar people that work for the company. In fact, real big companies have people working in the data processing department that are like database liaison type people, and their whole job is to help users properly define the reports they want to run and help them fill out the forms that they need to fill out to get these reports and stuff. So you definitely want to find as many people like this. Sometimes you might want to call around the company if you can't find printed lists. Just start calling and, you know, asking for Joe Blow, vice president. And when his secretary answers, you say, Mr. Robertson. I usually try and call, like, either real early in the morning, because top executives don't like to come in to work real early any more than we like to get up real early. So that's usually a good time to call, or close to the lunch hour. But when you do that, you risk the secretary being at lunch, too. So the timing of the calls, you don't want to call when Joe Blow is really there, because if she tries to transfer your call and now you've created a situation where you've exposed yourself to some degree. So, you know, it's sometimes you might have a ruse ready, like you're selling something or you're a headhunter, but that doesn't work with high-level executives because they don't get those kind of calls. So you get this secretary and you try and get her cooperation. And one of the best ruses that I have found is the clueless newbie. I mean, you just say, "Hey, you know, I'm new at this company and they've asked me to do this, to get this report or whatever," and you specify the criteria here, and you say, "You know, but I don't even know how to go about doing this, you know, can you help me," or whatever, and people are really helpful, especially, again, data processing people, you know. They like to show off that they know the system and how well they know it. Again, a lot of them are just paid to be, like, customer service or corporate service, such as it is, where the users call in and, you know, want information, and they provide it. The key thing is just to have enough information about the company that you're using the proper terminology, that you don't raise any red flags. One of my favorite ways, and this is not required for this particular hack, but I really like this method of getting passwords. So I'm going to display this method. Can you guys all see this if I draw on here? No? Do you have, is there a sheet that can draw on there? Do they have any of the clear sheets to draw on? Basically, it's pretty easy. What it is you, if you want to get a password to a system, one of the most successful methods I've used, and I posted this in Usenet, and I got so much email from it that I thought, well, maybe, I don't know, maybe they haven't already yet, so I'll tell it again. It's where you play two ends against the middle. And this is the mistake that a lot of hackers make, is that they leave these loose ends hanging around. And it's really important to tie up all the loose ends when you do a social engineering or psychological subversion penetration. So the way to get, one of the, my favorite ways to get passwords is you call into the data processing department and you say, this is Judy in accounting. And you have a real name here. You don't want to use anything that would arouse suspicion. So you use a real name and you say, this is Judy in accounting. And when I was typing my password in a few minutes ago, there was this guy standing behind me, and I think he was watching when I typed it in. And since I'm responsible for the data that's in my account, I would feel a lot better if you guys changed the password. And this kind, helpful person at the other end of the line, whose job it is to be of service to the users in the company, says, yeah, we really appreciate you taking such care with security. I wish all the users were like you, blah, blah, blah. And most companies have a pretty ridiculous policy of just assigning a password right there. If the company has a policy of mailing the password through intercompany mail, it's easy to fight that, especially if the computer center is off-site or even on a different floor of the building. You just say, hey, I'd rather you don't send the password through intercompany mail because, I need it now. I need it today. Please. And then if they say, well, come on up and get it, you can try to fight that by saying, well, I'm just really busy. I don't think I can get away from my desk right now. You know, most of the time you're not going to run into this, and I do have a solution for that, which I'll get to in a minute, but I want to stick with the thread here of, you've got Judy calling into the data processing center. Okay, now you've got Kathy in the data processing center, assigns Judy a password. Okay, Judy thanks her very much for this password. Some companies will ask you, what password do you want? Other companies assign it randomly or off of a list or whatever. So now you've got Judy's password. And see, this is where novice hackers get into big trouble. What happens when Judy logs into her account and can't get in? Now she calls the data processing center and she's the real user. And now she's going to arouse suspicion because she can't get into her account. Kathy's going to say, well, didn't you call an hour ago and say you lost your password? So you see, you're inviting trouble if you don't, what we call middling. You middle the attack or the penetration or encounter, whatever terminology you want to use. And you play both ends against the middle. So then what you would do is you call Kathy. Now remember, Kathy was never really there, okay? I'm sorry, I'm backwards. Judy was never really there, okay? So now you're going to call Judy and tell Judy that you are Kathy in the data processing department, okay? Because now, see, Judy's password has been changed because you called impersonating Judy. But Judy doesn't know what her new password is, so you have to get that password to her without arousing suspicion. So you call Judy and say you're Kathy in the data processing department. And Judy, this is Kathy in data processing, and we changed some passwords this morning as a routine security measure. Try not to laugh when I'm saying that. And you, ask Judy to please make a note of her new password. Now remember, you know, most people don't remember passwords. You ask her, you know, please, for security reasons, keep it in your purse until you have it memorized. Don't tape it to your terminal. I get off on giving the little lecture about security while I'm compromising it. It's just sort of something that... So you see what's happened here is that you have played both ends against the middle. You have a password to the system, and neither the user or the data processing department knows that a hacker has just gained access to the computer. Okay, is there anybody that doesn't understand this technique? Did I explain it well? Or are there any questions? Yes. Okay, the question is, I've given a scenario from the standpoint of being a woman, impersonating a woman, and how would you handle it if you were a man? Basically just the reverse. You find a guy that works in accounting, and, you know, you play Michael against Robert. I mean, there's plenty of men that work in data processing, too. In fact, probably a lot more than women, but that's a good question. Thank you. Yes. Okay, the question is, what if Judy and Kathy know each other? I would venture to say that you're screwed. pretty much, if you have an off-site computer center, which is most of the time when techniques like this are going to work anyway, the chance of the users knowing each other is very small. So you've probably compromised that mission. You can try again the next day with two other people, or that afternoon if you're in a hurry. But pretty much, you know, you've got to remember here, the risk to yourself is very minimal. You have not exposed yourself in person. You're just simply making a telephone call. And although the mission is blown, at least you haven't suffered any exposure. That's a good question. Yes. That's a very good question. What if they require old passwords to change? You can call Judy saying that you're Kathy and you're going to make some, you know, routine password changes. And Kathy wants to make sure she's really talking to Judy. So can I confirm your identity by getting your would you tell me your password? This is actually a little quicker method to getting passwords, but it entails risk because you haven't had an opportunity to middle. You know, you haven't been able to play both ends against the middle and tie things up. If you run into an unlucky circumstance where they really do change the passwords the next day or in a couple of days, then you might have Judy asking, yeah, we just changed your password 2 days ago. And Kathy says, no, we didn't. So that's kind of why this particular technique is the preferred method. Yes, sir. Okay, the question is, what about systems where the user is responsible for his own password? Do you mean where the user has the privilege to change his own password? Again, you can call and say that you are Kathy in data processing and, you know, you are going to be implementing a new security procedure. They don't think. If you call, most people that work in companies don't answer every phone call with the idea in the back of their head, now this person is social engineering me. You know, I mean, they answer the questions unless a red flag goes up, unless somehow you've aroused suspicion. Most people are going to be very cooperative. But in a system like you are mentioning, basically, you probably aren't going to middle. You can try and get Judy's password from her somehow and just do your access and get it done and hope the password lasts for a while because you're really not going to be able to play both ends against the middle. It's a really good question. Thank you. Yeah. That's a very good idea. Okay. He just suggested that one way you might defeat the user that assigns his own password is to call the guy and say that, what was it, we're running a... Oh, you're running a password security checker, and they've assigned themselves a password that's easy to guess, so would they please reassign their new another password or something and make a suggestion? Yeah. Right. This was done to Netcom users. You call the users and tell them that you're doing a service survey and ask them a few irrelevant questions about service and then ask them for confirmation of their identity. Would they please provide their password as confirmation? Another way that Netcom passwords were compromised was using SAS SARTs to sit on a telephone line that the customer service personnel were using. Just listen to the phone calls. It's useful too. Any other questions? Yeah. Okay. Can you guys hear what was being said? He suggested that you could, when you're calling from outside of the PBX, that they can tell that you're an outside call, and that would compromise your access to, like, let's say, the data processing department or posing as a user. And somebody else suggested that what you do is you call the operator and have her transfer you to that party, that might defeat that. Did I get that right? That's a very good idea. What he suggested is that you knowingly call or ask for an erroneous extension. And when you get the erroneous extension, then you would say, would you please, forward me or transfer me to such and such. That's really who I wanted. And then they transfer you from within the system and you wouldn't show up as an outside caller. Is that what you... Okay. I'm sorry? Right. Okay, he suggested that as part of the middling process, he might actually call Kathy and have Kathy transfer you to Judy, and then you could better pose as Kathy. These are really good ideas, and depending on the security that the company employs, that you might want to consider them. I have found, and I guess I just human nature or something is, I don't know, don't have the respect for people that I used to years ago. But most people can be compromised so easily that they won't even think of looking at their phone to see whether the call was coming in from the outside. And even if it was, they probably wouldn't realize the significance of it. Again, people, day to day, and picture yourself in your own job, day to day, you handle how many inquiries, situations in the company where you talk to other people in the company. And how many of those would you really think would be a hacker conducting social engineering? It's like people don't think about this constantly, except in very secure environments. And then even then, they don't think about it as much as they should. Yes? He's asked, how would you deal with a small to mid-sized company where the employees are likely to know each other? Again, you probably will not have the benefit of middling or hiding. You probably just have to make a one-time penetration. Nowadays, they've got these voice scramblers and repeaters and stuff that let you impersonate somebody else's voice. Now again, you know, this gets into, well, how bad do I want access and what's it worth to me versus how much trouble am I willing to go to get it? You might try a more conventional tactic first. One way that I have gotten around the small company scenario is posing as a new employee or a temp employee. You know, I was just brought in here by account temps today to look over the books. You know, I can't get into this stupid computer. My username is Judy. You know, I don't know. Judy is showing me how to use the computer, to tactics like that, but you probably won't be able to middle. Yes? Okay, we're getting back onto the topic here. Thank you. I like this password theory. It's interesting stuff. Okay, the way that we're going to get this data here is that we've gone into the trash bins and we've retrieved sample forms. We've got an intercompany memorandum form. We've got company letterhead. Hopefully we've acquired some names through either the corporate reports, shareholders reports, public relations material that the company freely provides to anybody that would like to have it. We've acquired a little bit of data about the company, and we have some names that are appropriate to use. In the case of the insurance company, a vice president in audit finance would like to have this report so that he can make predictions of, he knows from his own experience working, that of these lapsed policies that exceed $250,000, with the beneficiary being 80 years or older, that the company is only going to pay 22% of these policies. So he's doing his forecasting and planning. So he wants a report that would tell him, list all these policies that have lapsed in the last year, so that he can figure out how much money the company is really going to have to pay out. So what he does is, big companies like this usually have, I'm not here, big companies usually have a form that users fill out when they want a report run. And this is a traditional thing on the big mainframes, when they would have to create job control language and punch cards and all this. It became a tradition to fill out these forms. I'm sure we've all seen them. They have little boxes and you have to get each character in the little box and all that. Well, there's variations on that theme now where they have a more user-friendly form. But basically, you just fill out the form and request the report and get that into the intercompany mail system somehow. And this is where we get into the tricky stuff. You know, of course, the traditional hacker method of getting this data, what's the traditional hacker method?
Dumpster dive.
Dumpster dive, and? Doesn't the hacker get a dial-up and dial in and start hacking at passwords? Use a dictionary program to find a password, and then print the data out on his screen or download it, you know, to his local PC or whatever. This is the hard way to do things. It's a pain in the ass to get passwords. It's a pain in the ass to get dial-ups and learn the, you know, command syntax. And what if you get a user account that isn't anywhere near what you need to do? You know, to me it's always been easier to just call up and order the report, have somebody fill the form out for you and slip it into the intercompany mail, and then you have FedEx come and pick up the report. No exposure at all. You know, you never show your face. You don't even have to reveal your voice. You just, you know, you can use voice scramblers. There's been some talk in Usenet about voice sampling, which is really fascinating. I was the victim of this one time where they got recordings of my voice and used some kind of fancy system to literally take syllables out of this and reconstruct alleged sentences that I had said. And then they tried to use that against me to, you know, incriminate me and file charges against me. And basically the way that I defeated that was I had it run through a VSA, which is a voice stress analyzer, It's sort of the equivalent, modern-day high-tech equivalent of the polygraph test. It's a lie detector test. And it measures the stress levels in your voice to determine whether you're being truthful or not. Well, it can also do voice printing, which would mean I would give a sample, many samples in this case, of my voice even making the same statements that they had in this forged voice file, this data file, and then play that into the VSA and get a voice print, and then play the forged material in, and the voice print will not match. You know, this VSA is very, very sophisticated. I don't know how many of you guys have been, and girls, have been subject to a polygraph test. Are you interested in a way to defeat the polygraph? Yeah? What happened to me was when I was younger, like single digit age, my stepfather took an undue interest in me, so to speak. And so, you know, my grades went to shit. You know, I had all kinds of problems. You know, that's when I started, like, phone freaking, was I got away from people and got into the telephone. And I used to dial all these different numbers and stuff to get weird tones. And I don't know, I inadvertently placed calls all over the world and stuff because I was just dialing numbers. I was like 8 years old. Well, by the time I was 11, the situation was like unbearable. My stepfather was coming in my bedroom every night and taking advantage and stuff. My mother did not believe me. She did not believe me that this was going on. And like most children, I exaggerated the story, trying to gain attention. I had turned basically, definitely a forceful encounter, but not a violent one, into a violent one. Because I was trying to get attention, to get it stopped. Well, finally, a counselor at school got it out of me, what was happening at home, and told my mother, and she still didn't believe me, and so they told the police. And now the police really didn't believe this. Now again, this is like years and years ago before people were aware of child abuse and stuff like that. Nowadays, this is, a kid says he's being abused, people take it really seriously. You know, how many years ago was it? 22 years ago. People didn't take this so seriously. So they wanted me to take a polygraph test. And I was scared to death of failing this test because I had exaggerated the story and said that the guy had hit me and everything, which wasn't true. So I went to the library and got some books on how to beat the polygraph. 11 years old. Yeah. Basically, it measures, they put a little thing on your fingertips and it measures sweat. And they put a band around your arm, and that's measuring your blood pressure. They put a band around your chest, and that's measuring your respiration. And they have one more. What else is it they measure? It's been a long time. Anyway, the heart rate. Okay, so they put the little sticker, round sticker things. So what I did was I learned that they ask test questions beforehand. And so I figured out by analyzing the test questions, if I lied during the test questions, the point of the test questions is to set the baseline, okay, so that they can tell during the real questions when you're lying and when you're not. So when the guy would say to me, I want you to tell me a lie now for the baseline, I would tell the truth. And then when he said, I want you to tell me the truth about something now, I would lie. And then to further screw the test up, I deliberately manipulated my breathing during the baseline only. I manipulated my breathing. I would twitch my fingertips, which does cause a little sweat to come out because you're moving. It causes the capillaries to expand, to dilate a little bit, and then this result in sweat. And it's a very sensitive device that can measure this. And when you press your feet real hard against the floor when you're sitting, it causes your blood pressure to go up. So I had, by using these three methods, I was able to create an ambiguous polygraph test. They did not get anything meaningful out of it at all. today, if I did that same polygraph test, I could probably defeat it because I've given demonstrations on this now. So, voice stress analysis, I've tried the same thing to try and defeat the voice stress analysis by analyzing the way that it processes the baseline. And this system is pretty secure. It can be beat. Some of the years, maybe 5-6 years ago, it could be beat. But the last 2 years, I've given a demonstration at Surveillance Expo, and the voice stress analysis is really good, and we should all hope that the courts don't start using it, because that's one more of our rights that goes out the door. Okay, so we're going to go back to the insurance company now. We're XYZ Insurance Company. And we've got the ABC Detective Agency that's hired us, and we want that new laptop, so we have to get this data out of his computer. Does anybody have any ideas about how we're going to, what we're going to do next? No ideas? Okay, what we've got is we've got the list of the relevant persons that work at the company. We've got all the people that work in the data processing department, their names and extensions, telephone extensions. We've got the people in the company that hypothetically could legitimately have a use for the data, who would be the hypothetical requesters. And what we're going to do is we're going to request a report on behalf of a legitimate user and intercept that report sometime after the computer prints it out. So, yes? Yes, I am. Why don't you come up here and use a mic? Because you've got like a really good training. Come here. No, come on. Come on. Because they're taping this. And I really wanted this to be like a workshop. So anybody that has ideas, please, by all means, this is for everybody to learn. Me too, believe it or not. Okay, go for it.
This is me keeping a low profile. John Galt. Pleasure to meet you, finally. I was just, my curiosity was raised by this because this bears a resemblance to my actual day job. So I was going to say that a lot of times we get requests from, it's called sorting requests by job title rather than when they came in. So, you know, the VP of finance calls in or their secretary calls in, and other things get dumped, and you do that immediately, and you want to get it out of there as fast as you can. In fact, right, so that might that might actually facilitate your odd request. You won't worry about an unusual request done immediately as a rush, rather than going to the normal channels where they'll think about it. And they'll make you fill out the right forms. You'll have to wait a week or two. But I was thinking also, when you're talking about ideas of how to get this, because, you know, normally, you know, you're leaving the building, you have the report in your hand, you drop it off in the internal mail or whatever, but off-site meetings would be good because folks always want, they're clueless, they're big picture managers, right? But they always lack the data, and they always want a discrete number, and they never want to understand what the number actually means. They just want a number for their answers. They want to know, like, the sales figures, but they don't want to distinguish between either how you're compiling the sales figures anyway. It's all about databases and corporate. It's my job. Anyway, point of it is, an idea for this is, you know, call up early in the morning, say your blah blah secretary, and you need to get this. He has a reporting over at the Edgewater Inn. He has a meeting over at the Edgewater Inn, and he needs these sales figures for his presentation. Have them faxed over there. He'll pick them up there. Poof, you've got them off-site already. You know, they run this report, then they fax over the Edgewater. All I have to do is spoof the Edgewater to pick them up instead of trying to get that through their internal mail. Or I didn't know what your FedEx thing. I was going to ask you about that, but having FedEx pick it up. But anyway, getting I sent some stuff to France once on nothing more than a voicemail, and they gave me a fax number, and I'm like, okay. Anyway, thanks.
Thank you. The way the FedEx would work is, you know, FedEx uniforms aren't really that hard to come by. God, you can give a FedEx guy $10 and just say, hey, go in and get this, you know, thing. I don't know. Actually, you've brought up some really good ideas. This is actually based on something that really happened. So I'm telling it from the perspective of how it really happened, rather than, that's why I'm asking for new ideas, because, I mean, I've learned a lot at these kind of conventions from people. You know, this is one thing, and I'm going to get up on a soapbox for a minute here. Climb up. I think 2600, alt.2600 on Usenet has gone to shit, okay? I mean, back in the 8BBS days, back when myself and Kevin Mitnick and Roscoe, Stephen Rhodes, even Captain Crunch was at the end of his hacking or freaking career, you know, it was like a competition to see who could leave the most useful and informative information. If a novice got on 8BBS and left a message, how do I blue box? There would be 15 responses, each trying to outdo the previous one, to show who was the greatest hacker or freaker. And I don't know what has happened in the last few years that the knowledgeable hackers have gotten up on their high horse and will not share information with the novices. But, you know, this is something we need to work together if we're going to get Big Brother, so to speak. I hate that term. But, you know, if we're going to keep an eye on the government, keep an eye on our loss of privacy, you know, we need to share these techniques and information instead of hiding it in these little cobbles, these little groups of elite hackers that most of these groups that I've run into, you know, they seem to pride themselves on this secrecy, but what ends up happening is if one member of the group gets busted, the whole group goes down, because now it becomes a snitch fest. And I don't know. Okay, we've just had a dissenting opinion here that okay, we've got people saying from a dissenting viewpoint that if you disseminate the information widely, you know, if you teach 200 people how to do something, then it's going to go away that much faster, or the technique will be ineffective that much faster. You know, basically, I don't know, like the hacker ethic. I know people have tried to define this in writing and explain from a moral or ethical standpoint what is hacking versus cracking and other types of definitions. But, you know, I was just thinking earlier today, this reporter was asking me something, and I thought of this idea. I don't know why, I've never really thought of this before. But you know what's really doing the hackers in? Is that every hacker that comes to the attention of the media gets that attention because he has gotten caught, because he has violated the ethics, because he has gone out there and done something illegal, destructive, basically against what most of us really believe in. You know, and so the media, no wonder they have such a negative impression of hackers, because all they ever find out about are the ones that get caught. And, of course, the ones that get caught most of the time are the ones that are out there ripping and roaring. So I think that probably what hackers need to do, if we value the reputation of the hacker in the classic MIT sense, the classic, you know, the hacker that seeks to gain knowledge or seeks to keep an eye on Big Brother, or seeks to keep a check on our freedoms or whatever, the traditional hacker ethic versus the cracker ethic, the destructive, the virus writers and people like that, that we need to get people to know that, you know, we believe in something and we have strong morals and values. And there was, is it Stephen Quatamoto? Is that correct? Is he here? He's got a web page up and a mailing list now. Is that the, am I getting it right, the Hack Pack or Hacker Pack? He's trying to form a political action committee. No, this is serious. I'm not sure I've got the name right, but there is a hacker that's trying to form a hacker political action committee. And they asked about whether hackers should go out and talk to the media and give interviews and try and improve the image that we have in the media. And I voiced the humble opinion that you're wasting your time. The media is going to take what you say out of context. They are going to take the sensational points and print those, the things that are of human interest or sensational value, feature value. They're going to print that and they're going to ignore the moral and ethical points that you want to make because that makes boring reading. Now, granted, there are a few publications out there that might be interested in that type of material, but unfortunately, most publications aren't. So if you really want to help the hackers and help those that come after you down the chain, the people you need to talk to is judges and probation officers. Now, again, this is just my humble opinion based on experience. These people are the ones that make the decisions about the sentences that hackers get. These people are the ones that are going to decide whether so-and-so hacker does a year in jail or 10 years in jail, whether so-and-so hacker, gets a light sentence and gets into a therapy program as opposed to doing 10 years on the chain gang. So go talk to probation officers and judges if you really want to help the hacker cause. But talking to the media is a waste of time. I mean, this Esquire story, I could go on about that. That's like nothing I said other than maybe the first couple paragraphs was even quoted accurately. So I'm kind of down on the media right now. Sorry, you guys in the back with the papers and stuff. But anyway, back to this insurance company here because I'm running out of time, actually. What we've got here is we've got the report. We're going to define the report. We're going to fill out this form, or we're going to call into the data processing department and request this report on the parameters that the client specified. The policies must exceed $250,000. The insured party must be 80 years of age or older. Policy has to lapse for 6 months, and the name and address of the beneficiary must be retrieved. So basically, you specify what you want in the report, and you either call in, if that's the method that the company uses to generate reports out of the computer, or you fill out the appropriate form and send it through the intercompany mail. And like this gentleman here suggested some ways to get that report out that were better than the method that we used. Yes? Right. Okay, that's a very good suggestion. Did everybody hear that? Do I need to repeat it? The problem with that, the only problem I see is that puts you at a physical exposure. And usually the effective psychological subversion, there is no exposure whatsoever. And that's a very good suggestion. And yeah. Oh, this is a really good idea. This guy has just suggested fake mail, send mail manipulation. Get into, port 25 somewhere and, hello, I'm so-and-so. Put the headers in and send it in, requesting your report that way. It's a very good idea, especially in the net happy 90s. Anybody else have a suggestion? Send a courier. This is actually the method that we employed, was to have a delivery service pick up the report. In this particular case, by the way, the report ran over 600 pages and was like this thick. on that fan fold big computer paper. So, you know, faxing was not a feasible option in that case. Yeah. Very good point, yes. Okay, yeah. Okay, what we have here, the question is, how would we get the report out of the inter-office mail and into a FedEx envelope or a courier envelope? Basically, what's happened here is that two techniques have been merged together. One of the techniques would be to utilize the intercompany mail to have it sent to another corporate location. And like one excellent suggestion that was made was have it intentionally sent to the wrong place, and then have the supposed right person go in and claim the report, claiming they need it right away and they don't want to wait for the intercompany mail to deliver it the next day. So you go in and retrieve it that way. That is being sort of confused with a technique where you have the report generated by the MIS department and have that report immediately inserted into a courier pack or printed up with the knowledge that it would be picked up by a courier. That would be specified on the form. That's useful in companies that have a data processing center in Colorado and the corporate offices in Manhattan to use this off-site sort of stuff, this courier type stuff, which might be faster than the intercompany mail. Yes. Okay, a suggestion that you might just want to get a room in the name of the executive that would have legitimate access to the report, get a hotel room in his name, and then have it faxed there. And if they wanted to check, they would find a real room with that real name. Okay. Basically, I've just been given the cut. We're running low on time. That means a few minutes or... Okay, does anybody else have any suggestions they want to make? Yeah. Okay. I thought we were getting raided. Well, the suggestion before the fireworks is that novices, and I don't like the term that was used, I don't like that term. Novices. that they should definitely, you know, RTFM before they start posing questions. There's some merit to that. I agree that seeing the same question, what is a red box, asked every day in Alta 2600 is annoying. But I think that the news group needs to be split up to novices and people that want to deal with novices and answer the questions and play net god and all that, and have a more intermediate news group for, you know, a more serious discussion about computer security and the hypothetical situations that arise when that security can be compromised. Basically, I guess that's pretty much it. You guys, tonight there's going to be a fundraising event for Kevin Mitnick. I'm pretty sure probably most people know who he is. And he's, this isn't like a legal defense fund, and the reason for that is because if we started a defense fund, the public defender's office would seize all the monies. So what we've set up is sort of an entertainment fund. And what this fund is doing is buying the books and magazines. We set up an account at Barnes & Noble, and Kevin can look in there. They have like a 200-page catalog, and he just orders the books and magazines that he wants out of the catalog. We also, it's been paying for his toiletries and personal effects and stuff like that. So if you guys would like to come to this fundraiser, it's $5 a person, and what you'll get for that is I've got my hacker archives. I'm bringing my traveling system, my 386, in, and it's just packed full of hacker files, utility programs. Most of them shareware and freeware. I also have the full Patriot archives, which were put together by David Starr. And I also have some of the log files from Kevin accessing different computer systems and stuff. If you have all the hacker stuff and don't care, the log files might be interesting. There's passwords and stuff like that in them that are kind of interesting. So if you would all like to come to this party tonight, it's going to be fun. And I'll be probably telling a lot of war stories, and we may even have a surprise guest that, I don't know, maybe it'll help out with this scavenger hunt thing or something. I don't know. Anyway, thank you very much. I appreciate your attention.